I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Maggie Lacoz, co-founder of La Bernardin, a leading seafood restaurant in New York City. Maggie started La Bernardin in 1986 with her brother Gilbert after operating the restaurant with the same name in Paris. When Gilbert died from a heart attack in 1994, Eric Repair took over as the restaurant's co-owner and chef. Maggie and Eric are co-authors of La Bernardin Cookbook. La Bernardin has been awarded 3 Michelin stars and has held 4 stars from the New York Times since it opened. Welcome.
Thank you.
What are your earliest memories of eating fish?
Oh, from the very beginning, I didn't like meat. So that was easy. When I was very young, 3-4 years old, I was eating in the dining room in our little hotel restaurant in Brittany with my brother, and we were eating fish.
So you lived in Brittany, and your parents operated a small hotel restaurant. How involved were you in the restaurant? What roles did you have?
We were involved very, very early, like peeling potatoes. We were stuffing clams. We were 7 or 8 years old. I was in the dining room with my mother, and my brother was in the kitchen with my father. And then my father had this idea, as he had 2 grown-up kids, to open a disco.
Tell me about the disco. This is now in the 1960s?
Yes, and it was one of the first disco in Brittany, so we were very successful, but we didn't know how to make money. And then later on, my brother was in his early 20s, he was working as in a disco in Paris. And then he really learned how to make money.
What kind of music played in the disco at the time?
The music of the Rolling Stone.
And your grandfather was a fisherman. Do you recall going out with him to catch fish?
Not me. I didn't like too much going on the boat, but my brother really liked doing that. And he preferred to go on the boat with my grandfather than to go to school, to tell you the truth. He was very young when he started to go on the boat with him. And one day there was a tempest that raised very quickly, and they had to tie him up with ropes to prevent him to be thrown away off the boat.
Did you both know from the early days that you wanted to go into business together and open a restaurant together? How did that happen?
Not at all. I wanted to be a stewardess, and my brother wanted to work on boats, but the kind of big boats where they go far away.
Cargo?
Yes, cargo.
Ah. Why did you want to be a stewardess?
Because I wanted to get out of Brittany and travel. That was it. I knew early in my life that I would not stay in Brittany. It was too remote, and I knew that there was a life somewhere else.
Eventually, you and your brother moved to Paris.
Yes.
But before opening the restaurant, you dabbled in different areas
yes.
for a few years. What are
exactly.
some of the things that you did?
I modeled for a couple of years. Then I was a receptionist in an hotel. Then I was hostess in a restaurant. And every year we would come back to Brittany to help our parents.
How did you both then make the decision to open the restaurant?
Because there was nothing else that we knew. We didn't know that it was going to be so difficult, because the small training that we had in that small hotel restaurant was not enough to make a success in Paris. So we opened that restaurant in Paris in 72 with the help of everyone, friends, family, loan at the bank. It was a disaster. We didn't know how to run the restaurant to make money. We were having fun being outside every night after when the restaurant was closed. And several times we thought that we had to file for bankruptcy.
Your restaurant was almost taken away at one point.
That's right.
What is the story behind that?
One day I went for whatever reason to the market with my brother. And we came back with the small car full of fish, and we saw a notice on the window, for sale. This is our restaurant, this is us. It said, so I called the number and a man came. He said, all right, young lady, I'm going to help you. Can we sit somewhere? I said, yes, please come to my apartment. It's above the restaurant. He said, I'm going to help you. We can just take a lean on your furniture. What do you have? Here, I have one table, which is my desk, and two chairs. And I have my bedroom, I have my bed, and that's it. He said, that's the only thing I cannot take. So it's to show you how difficult it has been.
But despite this difficulty initially, you were actually opening a restaurant at an auspicious moment. Your brother, who was a chef with no formal training, benefited from a new experimentation going on in the French culinary community at the time. What impact do you think that had on your brother's cooking?
It was the beginning of the nouvelle cuisine. He tried to have some imagination. All the chefs were trying new way to get out of that heavy French cooking. So it was, in a way, the right time. He became friendly with all the chefs of his generation, went to have dinner with them, started to travel with them. They were always invited everywhere in France, whether it's to taste the truffles that were coming out or to taste wine. That's when everything started to come in his mind, I suppose.
And the first restaurant was called Le Bernardin.
It was called Le Bernardin, yes.
What does that mean?
It is a song that our father was singing to us called Les Moines de Saint Bernardin. Those monks were well known for the good life. They liked to eat and to drink. And that first location was on the left bank, not far from the restaurant that we were going to open. So we named the restaurant after those monks.
So you're talking about monks in a monastery? There's a monastery,
yes,
close to you? And monks obviously are known for their asceticism.
Yes, not those one.
I see. And so your father would sing this song to,
yes,
you growing up?
Yes. It's a well-known song.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Maggie Lacoz, co-founder of Le Bernardin, a leading seafood restaurant in New York City. Maggie started Le Bernardin in 1986 with her brother, Gilbert. You operated the Paris restaurant from 1972 to 1987 in two locations.
Yes.
And the impetus for your closing the restaurant in Paris was that you opened up a New York restaurant.
Exactly.
In 1986.
Yes.
Why did you decide to move to New York?
It's very difficult to say because I didn't know New York. It's out of the blue. I was pushed by I don't know what or who, but it was very strong. And I started in the 1980 already to think about New York. I came once with my brother and we stayed 2 weeks, and my brother said, there is nothing here, there is no good vegetable, there is no herb, there is nothing, there is, we cannot open a restaurant. And I told him, you are a coward. But he said, no way, we are not ready, and this town is not ready. We cannot do it. So a few years later, I told him, I don't want to stay here all my life. You will be 50 years old with a big belly behind your stove, and I will be with white hair at the entrance. I told him, I don't want a family. I'm not interested. I just want to run another business.
So you're eager to open a restaurant in New York. Your brother, not so much. What next? You tried a few times to start a restaurant, but investors repeatedly fell through.
It took me several times. One time I thought that I had everything. I had 10 different investment partner friends. And at the last minute, there was always one who would say no. And one year, I came back and I had almost a nervous breakdown because a deal didn't go through.
And then finally, a partnership randomly came together with essentially a stranger in New York City.
You met Mr. Holloway, who was the head of Equitable.
Yes, he was the chairman of Equitable.
And Equitable is the real estate company that owns the building that you've been in.
Yes.
How did you meet him?
We met him through a friend of mine whose brother was a very good friend of Ben Holloway. And he knew that he was building, he was finishing that huge building on the west side, which was not at that time a very well-known location.
155 West 51st Street.
So we went to his house. We opened a bottle of Dom Pérignon. We shook hands, said, that's it, we have a deal. Do you have an architect? Yes, we do. Tell your architect to get in touch with the architect of the building tomorrow. Do you have a lawyer? Yes, we do. Tell your lawyer to get in touch with the lawyer of the building and let's work on him. I said, but we don't have a deal. He said, we'll work on that. So they started to build the restaurant. We signed the deal 6 months later. He had so much trust and confidence with us that he knew that we were going to do it.
What was the restaurant landscape at the time in that neighborhood in Midtown?
It was not a good neighborhood. At night, we had some of our employees who were mugged. Nobody thought that it could be a right location. And we thought that it was going to be a right location because we were next to Rockefeller Center and next to Broadway.
But it was kind of accidental that you launched in this neighborhood.
Yes, that's right, because we had a very good deal.
How did you get financing from the beginning? Even you had Equitable as your landlord.
Yes.
But did they provide the capital to get the restaurant off the ground?
It was a turnkey operation.
A turnkey operation?
Yes, meaning that they would do all the work and then buy table, chairs, china, glassware, everything.
Lucky you.
Yes.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Maggie Lacoze, co-founder of Le Bernardin. We'll hear more from Maggie coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Maggie Lacoze, co-founder of Le Bernardin, one of the country's leading seafood restaurants. Maggie started the New York restaurant in 1986 with her brother Gilbert, and Le Bernardin received 3 Michelin stars and 4 stars from the New York Times as soon as it opened. She partnered with celebrity chef Eric Rappaire after Gilbert died in 1994. The restaurant changed its decor to produce a more contemporary feel in the autumn of 2011.
Now, your brother came to New York kicking and screaming because it was your wish. Did you ever think that maybe you and your brother should part ways because you wanted to be in New York and he wanted to be in Paris?
Well, no, we were very, very close and that was enough.
Your brother was protesting that there are no good herbs and no good vegetables. Where did he find, or where did you both find, the produce and the fish for your restaurant in Midtown?
The good thing was that New York is on the water, so Gilbert figured out that some fish were going to come to New York. He just had to find where to find them. He went to the Fulton Fish Market. Was the first restaurateur ever going to the fish market. That was very interesting because he made the fish market discovered by the journalist who came with him, and then the TV went with him to the fish market, and suddenly the fish market has been known, and then the fishmonger was happy to be on TV, so we were treated very well with them.
So your brother brought publicity to Fulton Fish Market.
Yes.
because journalists and the TV crew would follow your brother.
Mm-hmm.
Now, your brother did not speak English very well.
Gilbert didn't speak English. So his way to connect with them was just pointing out the fish and just pointing out the fish that they wanted to sell, which is no good. He would say, no, no good. And that was it. And after a while, they understood that he really knew how to choose the fish.
So your brother was an expert in fish thanks to his family upbringing.
Yes, thanks to my grandfather, who was the fisherman.
And when you were first launching the restaurant in 1986, what were some of the challenges that you faced?
We could not find waiters. So we took our maitre d' from Paris with us, and the dining room became a school for 1 month. And we had at that time the biggest kitchen in New York. We had the first page of the New York Times with a picture of the kitchen. And we were serving dinner every night in the kitchen to train the waiters. And then we started to train waiters in the dining room, like having just 5 or 6 tables and increasing every day. And we had no publicity, no public relation to help us, just people would see that there was light and that the Bernardin, they heard that the Bernardin was opening, and they would knock at the door and say, when are you going to be open? We said, we don't know, when we will be ready. And one night, Gilbert said, okay, we'll be ready soon. Maggie, you get 50 people in the dining room and nothing else for 1 month.
Do you remember what was on the menu the first night when you opened?
We had raw fish on the menu. Nobody in New York had eaten raw fish except in a few sushi places. So I would take the order at the table with the maitre d' and convince people to try to take the raw fish. And I would say, please, try it. And if you don't like it, we'll give you something else. There was a lot of tuna in New York. And the tuna, when it's too cooked, it's not good at all. So I said to my brother, listen, why don't we serve it raw? So we had carpaccio of tuna. We had some raw fish marinated that we serve on green salad. We had sea urchin, which was not very popular. So we had a sea urchin in a butter of sea urchin. We had oyster, of course. We had oyster with truffle, which was very unusual as well. We had fish soup. We had skate.
Squid.
Yes. We had served monkfish, which was not very well known either, that we would serve with leeks.
All that on the first night?
Oh, yes. When we were ready, we were ready. And every week, I would increase a little bit.
Now, your responsibilities were always split between your being in the front of the house and his always being the chef. Did you ever try to cook yourself?
No, I never tried because I never had the opportunity. That was not the tradition in the 50s and 60s to have women in the dining room. It was women in the front and men in the kitchen.
You mentioned that your brother had no traditional training and
That's
that
right.
He was really more of an artist and he used his imagination. How did that help him in the kitchen, do you think, versus having a formal training?
Because our food was different, was very light. There was some broth, then emulsion.
Emulsion.
Yes. Spices, herbs. His menu was simple, but that's what was important because then really people started to appreciate the fish. And the fish was so fresh that it was really good.
You mentioned green salad, that you served fish on top of green salad.
Yes. Oh, that was a big deal.
What was Gilbert's relationship with salad?
Oh, a nightmare. Because we had customer coming and asking for a green salad. And he says, no, we are not serving green salad. I said, why not? Because you are in the restaurant, it's a fish restaurant, and I don't go to the fish market every night to serve a green salad. That was it. We would not serve green salad.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Maggie Lacoze, co-founder of La Bernardine, one of the country's leading seafood restaurants. Maggie started the New York restaurant in 1986 with her brother Gilbert, and La Bernardine received 3 Michelin stars and 4 stars from the New York Times as soon as it opened. The restaurant changed its decor to produce a more contemporary feel in the autumn of 2011. Incidentally, when exactly did you open the restaurant to the public?
The restaurant was ready by November 1985. We knew that it was not the right time to open in the middle of the season, but we opened in January, which had always been successful for us. All the restaurants that we opened in January.
What were some of the mistakes you made in the early days of the restaurant?
I don't think we made mistakes. We were strong enough not to open the restaurant and to accept a lot of customers the first 2 months. So when Gail Green, who was the first person who reviewed the restaurant, came, the restaurant was ready. Her friend was telling her, you must go to the restaurant, it's really good. She said, I promised them not to go before they tell me that they are ready. So finally she came, and Brian Miller came right away.
Brian Miller of the New York Times.
Yes.
Which gave you 4 stars.
Which was a big deal for him because it was the first, it was at the beginning of him being at the New York Times, and it was the first 4 star that he gave. In his first article that he did, he said, I wish that we can take their passport so that they don't go back to France. And suddenly we were overwhelmed with the phones. We couldn't answer the phones. We had 5 person on the reservation, and it was not enough. We had to buy a sophisticated answering machine to take over. Nobody could reach us. It was very special. It was special days.
When you got your 4 stars from the New York Times,
yes.
Do you remember that moment when you found out?
Yes, we found out because by coincidence, we had that night friends coming from France, and I said, you arrive right on time. Tonight we are going to see what we are going to get with the New York Times. And the manager came at that moment with plenty of New York Times in his hands and threw away the newspaper in the restaurant.
The manager threw the newspaper in the air.
Absolutely. And in the private room, we had a reservation. It was 15 people. And they were all people from the New York Times. They all came down the stairs, and everybody was applauding.
Oh.
And everyone in the restaurant started to understand. So everyone started to applaud, and it was really a wonderful moment. And then we went outside to celebrate. When we came back, we called our father and explained him. And he said, so, you didn't go to the Fulton Fish Market this morning, my son?
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Maggie Lacoze, co-founder of La Bernardine, one of the country's leading seafood restaurants. Your brother, Gilbert, passed away in 1994 from a heart attack?
From a heart attack, yes.
Was it sudden? Was it?
Yes, it was sudden, but not really. A year before, he had a kind of small attack. At night, he woke up and his girlfriend, she rushed him to the hospital. And 3 days later, he asked the maître d' and Eric and the manager to come to the hospital with the mail, and in front of them he took all the tube that he had in his hand. He said, I am fine, and don't say anything to my sister or you will be fired.
So he took out all the tubes, all the needles and tubes from the hospital?
Yes. If I had known, I would have battled and fight with him so that to do the test. He was supposed to do tests that he never did.
So your brother kept his heart attack a secret so you wouldn't worry and force him to undergo a series of tests.
Yes.
Eric Repair, your now chef and co-owner,
yes.
Came on board, took over in 1994 when your brother passed away. Eric had been working in the kitchen with Gilbert.
With Gilbert, yes.
What was that relationship like?
Gilbert was very friendly with Jean-Louis Paladin, a very well-known chef who was running a restaurant in the Watergate Hotel in Washington. He's the first French chef who came to the United States. And Gilbert asked him if he had someone that he could recommend because he knew that that could not go further than what he has done, that he really need new blood. And Jean-Louis Paladin introduced him to my brother. And Eric took like a few months before Eric accepted it. They were meeting every Saturday at breakfast and talked about everything. They became friends before they became the chef of the restaurant.
Now, Eric's style of cooking is very different from your brother's. Gilbert was more ad hoc and there's no formal education, whereas Eric is well-schooled.
Oh, yes. Eric has the best training.
How is that manifested in the menu? How is the menu different as a result of now having Eric on board versus Gilbert?
When Gilbert died, I said to Eric, Eric, we have to stop. Don't do it at all, anything that Gilbert was doing, except the raw fish. We'll keep that, and everything has to be new.
How come?
Because I wanted to really to show that I should no longer think of my brother and that Eric was a chef and that he was talented and that I wanted to show his talent.
I could see it going the other way. I could see some owners saying, I want you to continue in my brother's tradition. So it was probably freeing for Eric to have that
yes.
license from you.
Yes, definitely.
When the reviewers came to review the restaurant under Eric's auspices,
yes.
what were the results?
It was Ruth Reichel in 1995.
And?
Four stars.
Four stars.
Yes.
New York Times. Are you tearing up because this
yes.
is emotional for you?
Absolutely. It's 40 years of my life. But I have Eric and I. We are very close. We are like friends. I consider him like more than a business partner. He's my family. He's like my brother in a sense.
And Eric is really the public face of the restaurant to some degree. The star of a TV series called Avec Eric,
yes.
and a judge on Top Chef. How do you feel about his taking on that role with the restaurant, whereas you're more, not behind the scenes, because you're in from the front of the restaurant, but you certainly don't have your own TV series, and you're not the one that has as much fame as he.
It's wonderful. I can go away whenever I want. And nobody is asking for me. Everybody is asking for Eric. It doesn't make a difference if I am there or not, because I have a computer everywhere I go. I do the administration work in the restaurant. So every day I speak with everyone and I look at the numbers and that's fine.
Now, how has your job changed from the inception, from 1986 when you opened to now? What does your job entail?
In 1986, I was in the front. I was at the podium greeting people and then going to one table to the other, seeing if everything was fine. Mm-hmm. And then I would be in the restaurant from 6 o'clock to midnight, saying goodbye to the last customer. Plus the work in the office, it was very long days.
How has your clientele's taste changed from the beginning of the restaurant's opening till now?
They are very sophisticated now, yes. I don't remember, but what I can tell you is in one night we could have 15 tables taking tasting menus with wine pairing. So it means that the clientele is really sophisticated. They know about food.
There are so many restaurateurs expanding and having 2, 3, 5, 10 restaurants, whether they're all in New York or in other states. How come you're sticking with La Bernardine only.
This is our choice. We like to be unique. When the customer comes, we want that experience to be very special. We always manage to be in the restaurant, either Eric or me, so that the customer can have that special experience. If they want to meet with us, we are there.
What is your diet like? What did you eat for breakfast this morning?
I eat cornflakes with skim milk, grapefruit that the restaurant prepare for me, and Greek yogurt. And lunch, it's green salad with vegetables and fruits.
How often are you eating in the restaurant?
Every day, lunch and dinner. And dinner, I pick up everything from the menu. I taste everything. And I sit down in the dining room, and I want to be served like a customer. That's where I see the details.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
My guest has been Maggie Lacoze, co-founder of La Bernardine. Coming up, we'll meet Andy Levine, co-founder of Six Men, a company that creates music cruise events. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.
Matine, vider quelques flacons, voilà ce qui est bon et bon, bon, bon. Et voilà la vie, chérie, rafa. Et voilà la vie, couvrez-moi le vent. Et voilà la vie, chérie, rafa. Et voilà la vie, couvrez-moi le
I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Andy Levine, co-founder of Sixth Man, a travel company focused on creating unique music events for music fans. Sixth Man organizes cruises that feature concerts with artists including John Mayer, Sarah McLachlan, Lynyrd Skynyrd, and Bare Naked Ladies. By spending a few days on a boat, fans receive a more direct experience with their favorite bands. Andy started Six Man in 2001 when he was 30 years old, and more than 30,000 fans have attended a concert cruise hosted by Six Man. Welcome.
Thank you.
Where did you come up with the name Six Man?
When I was in high school, I played basketball, and I wasn't the starter, but I was what they call the sixth man. It refers to, in basketball, the first man off the bench. They're not a starter, but they play a lot during the game, normally a utility player. And on my high school basketball team, that's what I was. I wasn't tall enough or good enough to start, but I often came off the bench when someone was hurt or in foul trouble, and really I was the hustler. And then when I got to college, I joined a band, and I wasn't very good at guitar, but I booked all the gigs. And so, again, there was this parallel starting to develop in my life, and then I began managing a band, and my focus was almost 100% on the relationship between the band and their fans, who I considered like their sixth man. So when I needed a name, I felt like Sixth Man was the consistent theme in my life, where I was the happiest and doing the best, the most impactful was when I was playing that role. So it made sense.
You grew up in Nashville, Tennessee. Your dad was an insurance broker, and your mom ran a shopping mall. How did you get the music bug?
My dad played guitar with my uncles. They would just play on the weekends and stuff, nothing professionally. So I was always around it, and my family was really into it. I think it wasn't until I got to the University of Florida that I was in college. You know, that's when you're most likely to join a band, I guess. And so I just, you know, I guess something just came alive, and I wanted to play guitar, and I learned, and there you go.
What role did you play in the band?
I played acoustic guitar and harmonica. And then the big joke was that they didn't have me plugged in for the first year I was in the band. I didn't know that, right? Because I'm on stage, and, you know, it's often the artist can't hear what the audience hears. And they used to play a joke where they'd be like, Andy, take a solo. And they all knew, and I would be back there, you know, doing this stuff. And the audience was looking at you like a puppy dog, you know, like, what's going on?
So if they thought that you weren't even talented enough to be plugged in, why did they want you in the band?
Because I booked all the gigs. I did all the work. You know, they felt like they were in a Argentina rock band because they just showed up and it was all ready to go. They used to say it's Andy Levine on rhythm guitar and PR. that was my introduction.
Did you ever think about doing something other than music promotion or music, anything related to music?
I think that I probably would have wanted to be like a coach of some sort, or maybe even a teacher. I was kind of just waiting for my entrepreneurial spirit to strike out, and I have some great instances I can remember where that happened.
What are some instances of your entrepreneurial expressions growing up?
Well, I remember when I was 16, I decided I wanted to start a company called Bagels on Wheels. I felt like people would want to have bagels and donuts delivered to their door every Saturday morning, and I figured out a way where I could make a good living doing that, and then I couldn't get anyone to sign up for that to be a customer, so that didn't work.
So here you are. Your band is not successful enough for you to make a living at it, and you end up in Florida at a record store?
I was working as a club called Rickenbacker's, actually, and it was it was a small club that was not doing very well. And being in the band, I had been to different colleges around the Southeast and noticed they had a pretty vibrant or thriving live or original music scene where bands were playing, getting paid to play their own songs. And there were some bands that were really successful, like Hootie and the Blowfish and Dave Matthews and Edwin McCain at the time. And so I felt like no one was doing that at the University of Florida, yet here we were in Florida, very desirable, lots of kids or lots of students. And so I asked this club owner, I said, hey, let me try to bring some of these bands in. And he said, all right, let's try it. And he said, how much do you want? I said, I don't want anything. I want half the profit. I want no salary. Mm-hmm. And we had a good time.
You were promoting these concerts at mm-hmm. the University of Florida, and then you became a manager for bands like Creed and Sister Hazel. You had a pretty intimate relationship with Sister Hazel. How did you go about launching Sixth Man and your first cruise concert?
It wasn't until 2001 and focusing on building the street team for Sister Hazel, which is the unit, their army that promotes them, leads the grassroots charge. Those bands, those fans kind of demanded a convention with the band. They felt like they had done everything we'd asked them to do to help promote the bands, let us sleep on their couch, put up flyers, call radio stations, buy the CDs, come to shows, et cetera, et cetera. And I said, yeah, they're right. They have done all those things. And so I went to the band and I said, guys, we got to do something for our street team. They've done everything. They've been amazing. And they said, let's do something. So we did a cruise in 2001 and we just invited 400 fans and we were scared to death. Mm-hmm. And some of the people in the company didn't even go because they're like, Andy, the band's going to fire us for trapping them on the ship with their fans. And I said, you know what? I'm not impressed with the music business right now anyway. If that's the way it's going to go down, then let it be. I had nothing to lose. As soon as we get on the ship, I told the guys, we're going to buy drinks for the fans for an hour and a half. You're going to have a Sharpie. We're going to make a toast to the fans. And I want you to walk around and sign everything you can and take every picture. Don't let them come to you. Go do it. Just go work the room.
Because the fans helped promote them.
They did. And I'm glad we did that because that really worked. And it set the tone. It said, hey, we appreciate what you've done. Let's have a great time. It's just us. We're out in the ocean. This is the essence of the music business, the bands and their fans on vacation. I got off the cruise and I felt like I had forgot I was in the music business. That's how pure it was. And so I said, I want to build this. This is it. And I called a few other managers that had bands similar to Sister Hazel, who had 400 or 500 fans. I said, I have this idea. We just did something really cool. Would you guys consider doing it? And they said, you get the whole ship and we'll be there. Well, then I realized you need $750,000 to get a ship for a weekend, a year in advance.
If you're reserving the whole ship, then you need $750,000.
Up front. So when we wanted to go from 400 people to the 2,000 people that it would take to do a full ship charter, the cruise line wasn't really sympathetic to my needs because here I was as some guy with an idea, and I'm sure they get that all the time. In fact, now I know they get that all the time. What I decided to do was, after I talked to those other bands, their managers that said they'd be there if we got the whole ship, then we put up a website and we started promoting the fact that we wanted people to let us know if they'd be interested. So we kind of left it open and we said, if you put a $99 refundable deposit down, that'll give us a way to gauge interest. And we got 1,000 people to put a $99 deposit down. And we figured our break even was right around $1,600 or $1,500. So I took that data and I found two local businessmen in Atlanta who kind of loved what we did, loved our spirit and probably could identify with it a bit because they were entrepreneurs themselves. And they loaned me $750,000. I remember two things about this. I remember going to the guy's house to get the check, and I was looking around, his wife and family. I said, how much money do you have to write a 30-year-old a $750,000 check, because certainly this isn't your last $750. You know, what is it? The second thing was that once he gave us the money, I noticed after the first day, there was like a 3 or 4 day gap before we had to wire to the cruise line. And I noticed we were making like $250 a day in interest. And, you know, at the time I was like, wow, that's a lot of money. I mean, that's more than we make on any day. And that's just for doing nothing. So I just remember, like, it was my first dealing with that kind of sum of things. And looking back, it was crazy. I mean, why he did it was just crazy. It doesn't make sense why he did it. And we ended up, I think we made $42,000 the first year.
So what is the answer to that question? If somebody's just going to write you a $750,000 check because he likes what you're doing, how much is that person worth?
I think he was worth about $15 million at the time.
How did this individual make his money?
He built a company that offers services to the auto industry, etched glass, extended warranties. And he had sold his company to Ford. Fast forward 5 years, he bought it back from Ford in 2008. And I think he bought it back for less than he sold it for. So,
I notice on your site you talk about living loud. Like, that's part of your mantra for Six Man, is live loud. I'm wondering if that naturally cuts off a certain demographic. What is the demographic of your base?
Well, live loud to us is basically identifying what your passion is and pushing it as far as you can while still being responsible to the rest of your life. We've done cruises, like you said, with Elvis. We've done cruises with Kid Rock, John Mayer. And the one thing I'll tell you, and you have to see this to believe it, is that everyone that steps on that ship, whether they're 25 years old or they're 65 years old, they have the exact same attitude and approach to life. And they're not going to bed early. And we're making sure that, you know, we got people, I mean, they're living. And they've come in there for one reason. They've saved up all year or whatever it is. And they are there to celebrate this passion. It's the purest form of your passion.
And it's a huge party for 3 days on a ship.
You know, I always tell people there's three crowds you can run with. There's the crowd that's going to run all day. And if you want to jump in there and try to run with them, go for it. There's the crowd that'll, you know, they'll stay up till 12 midnight and they'll push a little bit. And there's the crowd that just, you know, they keep a normal balancing. They're in the gym in the morning. They do a couple of things, have a nice dinner, see a show, but they're in bed. So you just got to pick your crowd.
And what crowd are you in?
You know, I started in the Top Gun, you know, the first 4 or 5 years. So I started out there, and now I'm a little more in the middle crowd, I would say.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Andy Levine, co-founder of Sixth Man, a travel company focused on creating unique musical events for music fans. Andy started Sixth Man in 2001. You have a blog on the Sixth Man website, and you spoke recently about starting your own company, and you talk about the dip, a term by Seth Godin, the author. You're talking about whether you quit when you're running some type of endeavor or you stick it out. You said that average kills you and horrible saves you. What do you mean by that?
Well, Seth Godin, I've read some of his books over the last few years, and as of late, there's a book he wrote called Tribes, and then he had another book called The Dip, which is like saying it's okay to quit. Like, don't beat your head against the wall. I have a father-in-law who's in this situation where he's running a print store. He's been doing it for 20 years. Nothing has changed. I see him, you know, twice a year. We go to lunch, and I have the same conversation. I said, why are you doing it? You know, what's going to make you change? And so I feel like it's kind of like I was in the band. I feel like people get stuck in it, whether it's relationships or jobs or, you know, ventures or whatever it is. An average can confuse you. Whereas if you're horrible, like my donut, Bagels on Wheels, where I got no customers, it was pretty easy. Or horrible, like the first girl I ever kissed, she's now a nun. That's horrible. See, if it had been okay, you know what? We might have dated, and it would have taken us a long time to realize we weren't for each other. There are some moments where it's just appropriate to say, this isn't working. Or, you know, at least hold yourself accountable to say, I'm going to keep going.
Did you ever face any of those moments while you were launching Six Man? Like, okay, is this kind of just average? And should I just kind of quit or stick it out? Or, boy, this is going well. Like, where was your mind as you were launching the company?
That's a great question. I think every entrepreneur has to, like, experience this. I can remember one time after doing the cruise for a couple of years as a charter, we were growing, but it was still a tremendous undertaking and tremendous risk, and we hadn't figured out a way to get the return out of it. But I didn't really care. you know, I could see it. I could see us getting better and better, and I could see the people coming back, and I could see something there. But the other people that were on, that were involved, the investors, were starting to wonder, where's the return? And so there was actually a meeting about whether to do it or not. And I'm like, guys, let's just do it one more year. We can do this, you know. And so we did. And sure enough, that was the year that it kind of tipped. You know, we put this event on sale, and for the first time, it sold out way in advance. The irony in all this is that we were doing it in the fall out of New Orleans. We had one scheduled. We sold it out almost a year in advance. All we had to do was push off, execute, come back, and it would have been a very profitable venture. And 3 weeks before we were supposed to sail, Katrina hit New Orleans. And Carnival leased our ship to FEMA. FEMA, I don't know if you remember, they did the housing on there and they used cruise lines. So I get a call from Carnival one day that says, hey, we're not going to be able to do your program. It's the only, you have to understand, like, I just found out my wife was pregnant with our second child. There was so much pressure for this event to work. And now it was pretty much, we were out of business. So some way I sat down, I wrote a letter to Carnival, and I just kind of outlined all the things we had done and how important it was for them to get us a ship or help figure out a way to make this right. And sure enough, after a couple conversations, it ended up going to the president of the company. And I think they really connected with what we were trying to do. And they, I don't know how they did it, but I got a phone call saying, hey, you know, you're right. And we're going to not only give you the money back that you paid for the ship, but we're going to help you recover all of your expenses and your profit. So, you know, that was a moment. Now, at the same time, you have to understand is that our guest, we had to notify our guest. And so what happened was we started getting phone calls and emails from guests saying, keep my money. Just don't go out of business. I look forward to this all year long. Please. I've met so many great friends. My new best friends I met on this cruise. That's when I knew, like, this is a real family we're building here.
So talk to me about the experience of being on the boat with one of the artists. Let's say John Mayer, for example. You know, I would imagine that the artist is exhausted after playing one night, you know, and the last thing they probably want to do is eat eggs with the fans in the morning when they wake up. And here they have to do it for, you know, 4 days, 5, sometimes 7 days. Was there ever any of that concern?
Well, it is. It's still to this day. It's the thing that everyone says, whoa, wait a minute. I'm trapped on a ship for 4 days, you know. But John Mayer, when he first got on the cruise, I don't think he even knew what he was getting into. I think his manager said, hey, let's try this. It'd be great. And he probably said, yeah, whatever. And he didn't think about it. But for John, he got on. I remember we were sailing out. He said, this is genius. He goes, this is genius. He goes, you know, the whole world may think I'm an arrogant jackass, but I'm going to show these people who I really am, because these are the people that care. These are the people that I want to show who I am. And he spent the next 4 days doing just that. He was in the disco every night DJing, and he's a horrible DJ. But he's pouring tequila shots for people. And you know what? People love that. Just watching him have a good time.
It sounds almost like a religious experience for you. Are you religious?
I am. I you know, we go to a church in Atlanta called Buckhead Church, and it's about just growing in your relationship, you know, with Jesus. And I feel like since my wife and I have been going there for the last 3 or 4 years, it's really been a really great centering thing for us.
But while you do go to a traditional church every Sunday, do you feel like these events on these ships are church-like, you know, getting a whole community of people together? And is there any of that for you, a spiritual component to
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. I know for a fact that the energy that is created and the moments that are had for people, they have to compete at that level. We have guests send us the letters we get. We have guests send us gifts. They send us lunch. There is some sort of exchange going, and a pure exchange that we're given and they're giving back.
We talk about these highlights on the cruises. What are some events that have happened that you might not want to talk about?
We had a situation with Kid Rock where we were supposed to go to Grand Cayman, and the weather wasn't looking great in Grand Cayman, so we decided the day we left to go to the Bahamas instead. The challenge was there was two couples that were supposed to get married in Grand Cayman, and they had family flying to Grand Cayman. I'm happy to say we figured out a way to get those people married in the Bahamas. Well, one of the couples, the guy pulled me aside and said, maybe this is a sign, so he didn't want to get married. But the other couple, we were able to get them married in the Bahamas. And in addition to that, at Kid Rock's Q&A on Sunday, and the last question was, hey, Kid Rock, we'd follow you anywhere, even if it means the Bahamas and missing our wedding in Grand Cayman. Can we get a picture with our best man? And so all of a sudden he says, get on down here, you know. So he takes this picture. So now these guys have a picture of them with Kid Rock in the middle with his arms around them. And behind them is 2,000 people out on a deck on a Sunday afternoon. That's better than any wedding they would have had in Grand Cayman. And I don't even know what they had planned. So I'm saying, like, that story happens on every cruise, one or two of them.
I'm just curious, you're such a music lover. What kind of music do you listen to when you're in your car or with your family?
The things that will never go away, like the James Taylor, Jackson Browne, the things that I just really just love. Those are my dreams. I mean, if I can get James Taylor or Jackson Browne on a cruise, like, that's going to be like the holy grail for me. Sarah McLachlan was that when she decided to come on the cruise, because we did a cruise with the Bare Naked Ladies and their friends, and she said, hey, I want to go on vacation. So she came and performed. And I remember meeting her and seeing her play, and she's just as pure an entertainer as it gets and a singer. She's just so good.
I would have never pegged you as a James Taylor or Sarah McLachlan fan.
Well, if it wasn't for James Taylor, I would not be sitting here right now, because he's the artist that made me want to pick up the guitar. But James Taylor was the drive that kept me up all night learning how to play guitar and hurt until my fingers bled. It still wasn't good enough to be plugged in, by the way. So, you know, glad I could shock you.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
My guest has been Andy Levine, co-founder of Sixth Man. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.